Chapter 1, I'd like to remind you of a few things that we've presently established in our study thus far. First of all, as we press on to day 2 of the creation account, I'd like to remind you that we must not read the text dressed in lab coats. This is not a reading for lab coats with a view to trying to make the Bible's creation account fit with the claims, the ever-changing claims, I might add, of modern science. This account, Genesis chapter 1, was given by God to and written for an ancient people. An ancient people who had an earthbound perspective with primitive notions of science and about who they were and how they got there and how they relate to God and people and the world in which they lived. And while it is, again, I must say, commendable that Christians committed to the veracity of the Scriptures and to science seek to scientifically explain the world in which we live from a perspective that corresponds in some way to what we read in the Bible, that's not the way we should read Genesis chapters 1 and 2. It was not written that way. It was not originally read that way, and neither should we read it that way today. The second thing we established is that we must read Genesis 1 and 2 for what it is. It is an ancient cosmogony. I have to correct myself this morning. Last week, I incorrectly used the word cosmology to speak of a story that accounts for the creation, the origins of all things, when I should have used the word cosmogony. Right neighborhood, wrong address. Cosmology refers to the larger category of the study of origins, origin stories, while cosmogony refers to the story itself, to the account itself. Cosmetology is distinguished from both of those. There is no cosmetology in Genesis 1 and 2. There may be a little bit in Song of Solomon, a little bit in Proverbs, a little bit in Paul's epistles about how women adorn themselves. It's a much more fun study, probably, than cosmology. You will look better and probably feel better at the other end of it, but no cosmetology in Genesis. Genesis 1 and 2 is an ancient cosmogony. And in fact, it's just one. It's one among many of its time, many in the world of its day. And while Genesis 1 and 2 has some striking similarities with these other ancient stories of creation, it also has some very stark differences that set it apart from other creation stories. My point from the start has been that we have to read this literature for what it is. If we don't, we completely miss the point. We not only get off on the wrong foot, but we ultimately end up at a place where God does not intend us to end up as we read these accounts, this account of creation. We don't have to try to fit dinosaurs in. We don't have to try to accommodate scientific carbon dating methods by bending and contorting the Scriptures. We don't have to posit theories of gaps or long days for creation or any such thing. But neither must we dismiss science because of what we read here in Genesis. We don't have to make science a nonsense or a big bad boogeyman to accommodate our presuppositions in any way, because that's not what this is about. That's not what Genesis 1 and 2 is all about. It's Genesis. It means beginning. It is the beginning. The beginning of the grand meta-narrative, the grand story, the big story, the beginning of the big story of creation and fall and redemption and ultimately consummation, where God makes once again everything new as He intends. This is a story to explain to people who they are, to explain to us how we got here, and who God is, and what God is all about, what He's doing, and how we ourselves fit into the great big story. Genesis starts us off in the story. It's the beginning, and that's the way that we should read it. As we noted last week here at the beginning, God really only creates two big things. Two big things, at least two large categories that answer the question, what did God create in 7 days? This series is entitled Questions in Genesis. And so we are answering questions as we move through Genesis chapters 1 through 11. First of all, we noted God created the functionally productive conditions to sustain human life. The functionally productive conditions to sustain human life. Excuse me. Last week I began to show you that Genesis 1 is really more about the creation of the functions of the universe than it is the creation of the matter of the universe. As I explained last week, Genesis 1 is an opening, an introductory statement of this ancient cosmogony. It merely introduces the creation story, and the creation story ends in chapter 2 and verse 4. What follows that introductory statement of verse 1, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth," is a statement in verse 2 of God's presence. His Spirit is there. His Spirit is operating and functioning in this, as of yet, non-functioning, functionless universe. That doesn't mean there was no matter in place. Matter was created already. Matter was already in place. Verse 2 begins with an earth and with water, but nothing functioning, nothing happened. And that's what the Hebrew word, the words of verse 2 say, that the earth was tohu and bohu, meaning that the earth was non-functional and not yet producing. And that's the point of verse 2. But as the days of creation unfold, what God is really doing, He's not merely creating matter, He's taking that which is unproductive, that which is non-functional, this earth, and He's making it functional and productive. And that's a very important point. And we'll continue to see that as we unfold it. He's making what is non-functional, non-functioning, unproductive, functional and productive. And He does it in the 7 literal days. The point of verse 2 is to tell the ancient Israelites and us what God really wants us to know about our origins. And that is that God built everything to function and produce. He built everything to function and produce. Days 1 through 3 in the first 13 verses or so of Genesis 1, these are all functions that are foundational to human existence in the world. Without these foundational functions, human life would not be able to exist. And so here in Genesis 1 is the functions that God put in place to make the world an environment that operated in such a way that it was working, first of all, that it was inhabitable, second of all, by human life, and third, that it was productive. And God, in verse 3 through 5, begins to put in place those things necessary to make that happen. That brings us to the first function that God created. We saw last week was time. Time. Day one. Subpoint number one. God created the basis for time. God said, "Let there be light," in Genesis 3. And there was light. God saw that the light was good, and He separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness He called night. And there was evening and morning, evening and morning, evening and morning, just as we experienced ourselves this day, evening and morning, to this very morning, evening and morning, since that first day. Before this first day, the earth existed in this state of non-functional darkness. It existed, but it didn't functionally exist. And so here in verses 3 through 13, God begins to put in place the functions of and for existence. And the first function is light. But light here isn't material. Light here is a condition. Light and darkness, alternating periods of morning and night as one full day, were put in place. In fact, as we noted last week, 3 full days before the bodies were created that mark and govern them, before they were put in place. Sun, moon, stars, planets. Yet already we have alternating light and darkness, before even sun is in place. God is instituting time here, day one. It's the continuum in which all humanity lives to this very day. Time is the function. Now the functionaries will come later, 3 days later. But for now, God institutes the function of alternating light and darkness day and night before sun, moon, stars, planets. The great cycle of time is already in place by the Creator. That brings us to day two. Let's pick up where we left off. Day two, God created the basis for weather. Created the basis for weather. With the continuum of space already in place, with the continuum of time already in place, and we all live in the time-space continuum. With these firmly in place, God turned his attention to preparing a habitat for humanity. And I say that with a wink and a nod to our friends from Habitat for Humanity who were with us last week. All that we see around us, God has created as his habitat for humanity. The separation of upper waters from lower waters, and the further separation of these waters from the land, which is found in day three. We find these things in ancient cosmogonies beyond Genesis chapter 1. Other creation stories of pagan nations, contain these same ideas, these same creations. Now, God was not merely creating what we generally call sky. Let's look at Genesis 1, 6 and 8, 6 through 8. God said, "Let there be an expanse between the waters to separate water from water." And so God made the expanse and separated the water under the expanse from the water above it. And it was so. God called the expanse sky. And there was evening and there was morning, the second day. Again, God's not merely creating the sky. Here, God was preparing the environment and preparing the mechanisms by which what we now call precipitation was controlled. That's what God is doing here on day two. He's preparing the environment and the mechanisms by which precipitation is controlled. The means by which weather operates. But God is doing more than giving the meteorologists on the Weather Channel something to do here. They were very busy last night. I don't know how late you were up, but they were very, very busy last night. Maybe you heard the emergency weather systems go off, and if you happen to have the television on. God is doing more than merely creating weather here. Cosmic order, everything that exists depends on just the right amount of precipitation. Too much, we drown. Too little, we starve. I think it's interesting that ancient peoples of the Near East, many of those at the same time of this writing who wrote down their own cosmogonies, they actually saw what we call the sky as something that was solid. It was as if it were a solid barrier that held back the waters of the heavens. The translation in some of our Bibles used the word firmament. So their heavens, this primitive understanding was a solid barrier that held back the threat. And it was a threat. The threat of the cosmic waters. Heaven's cosmic waters. And they lived with a constant fear. A constant fear of the heaven's waters being unleashed meaning that they lived with a constant fear of annihilation by drowning. Annihilation by water. But they also, on the other hand, they also lived with a constant fear that the firmament would be too solid. And it would not yield enough water, allow enough water to come to earth. And so they also not only lived with a constant fear of flooding and drowning, but also a constant fear of famine and starvation. I'll come back to this fear at the close of this sermon. Of course, we know that there's no solid barrier holding back the rain and controlling the precipitation of the world. But what God was doing then is what both we and the ancient Israelites know that God was doing, and that is He was setting up, He was maintaining a weather system, something that is essential to plant life, and we know that here in the Midwest. Something that is essential to animal life. Something that is essential to human life. And that brings us naturally and in order to day three. Day three, God created the basis for food. We've seen the creation of the basis for time, the creation, the basis for weather, and now the basis for food. We see this in verses 9 through 13. Again, we know this in the breadbasket of America, that if you're going to maintain human and animal life, you have to have land. You have to have land. Land in order to produce food. The functional conditions for the food chain are being instituted here on day three. The cycle of vegetation and fertilization and the blessing of harvest's produce. All of these immediately put into place. Fully mature, producing plants and trees put in place. Why? Because animal and human life is coming next. Do you see the order here? Do you see what God is doing? How He's preparing the place, the environment, for human and animal and plant sustenance? Again, all of these functions that we see in the first 3 days are commonly expressed in other cosmogonies of the world, the ancient world. Time, weather, food production, all terrestrial operation, functions necessary to sustain human and animal life on earth. All essential foundations for life. Incidentally, life that's going to relate to one another and relate to God and depend upon one another and depend upon God for their existence, for their survival. And that's a very important point that I want to come back to and revisit here in just a few moments. Now, before we move on to day four and the function areas that God is going to create to correspond to the functions of days 1 to 3, let's consider God's work here in days 1 through 3 and what that means for us. First of all, I think it means that our God, the one who created all that is, our God is a God of infinite wisdom and might. Science really does God's people a tremendous, tremendous benefit. Science, good science, shows us how great our God is. The intricacies and the interdependence of this cosmos, just the intricacies of the human eye and how it operates and functions so that we can see. Science helps us understand just how great our God is. Let's not villainize it, as Christians often do. Do you think they got things wrong? Yeah, they do. Some say, you know, when they start making faith statements about origins, yeah, I think there's a better explanation for it. But what we see in science and what we learn from science tells us how great our God is. He's a God of infinite wisdom, infinite might. We are fearfully and wonderfully made, even ourselves and our own bodies, scriptures tell us. And think about the great care that God used as He created this environment and as He put everything in its place, the delicate intricacies of synergistic interdependence. In other words, the fact that God created the world in which we live to function and to work together to sustain us with a precision and balance that is evident throughout all of it. That should put us, Christians, should put us in a frame of mind, first of all, for worship. But it should also put us, I believe, on the front edge of environmental concern. If for no other reason than it honors God for us to do so as we honor what He has done.
The work of caring for God's creation is an act of worship when you think about it. It's a means of serving God, and we're going to continue to explore this idea as we move through the narrative. Second, looking at these first 3 days of creation, our appreciation for God's creation and work should motivate us to be up front, to be one of the leading voices in environmental stewardship. Seems like we Christians are always lagging behind. We should be thinking people, well-educated people, thinking people who are out front, who have an environmental position as a witness in our culture that reflects not a political party, but reflects the Word of God. And as we've already seen in Genesis 1, since God built functionality and productivity into His very first acts of creation, our approach to the environment should reflect a balance between sustainable usability and conscientious preservation. That's what we've seen thus far in these first days of creation. Our position, our views on the environment should reflect both of those ideas: sustainable usability, conscientious preservation. God strikes that balance. And so should we strike a balance between the wackos on both sides of the environmental issues in our culture. Disregard for God's creation, a heartless, utilitarian kind of approach, often fueled by corporate greed, often reflected in corporate abuse of our natural resources. Drill, baby, drill, BP, with little thought given to costly contingencies and having safeguards in place. That is not God's view. That is not God's view of care, of stewardship, of His created environment that sustains us. However, neither is an ecological approach that deifies both creature and creation to the extent that usability and functionality that God intended to sustain us is completely restricted. Hug a tree, but don't worship a tree. Everything likes to be hugged. Well, most everything. God strikes a balance, that's my point. He strikes a balance between thoughtful conservation and practical use, and that should form a theology of the environment for God's people. As we see why man is created later, I'll build on that idea. And this theology that God's people should have in place should be being heard in the cultural discussion. There should be prominent Christian informed voices. And I keep waiting to hear from them. Waiting to hear with patience. Fading patience, I might add. We need those voices. We need Christian thinkers out there on the cutting edge, being part of the policy discussions, as salt and light in God's world. And so worshipful work and strategic stewardship, this should be our response to the foundational functions that God created to sustain the creatures of His creation. And that brings us to days 4-6. The creation of the functionaries. The creation of the bodies that God puts in place to carry out the functions and to provide the context for creaturely relationships. Letter B, He created the fundamental creatures to sustain human life and relationships. He created the fundamental creatures to sustain human life and relationships. Day 4 marks the point where God begins to put in place the bodies, the functionaries that correspond to the days 1-3. Day 1, God instituted light and darkness, time. Day 4, 3 days later, He puts the bodies in place. Day 4, God created the functioning bodies to govern time. Subpoint 1 in your outline. Letter B was He created the fundamental creatures to sustain human life and relationships. Subpoint 1, He created the functioning bodies to govern time. Verses 14 through 19, God said, "Let there be lights in the expanse of the sky to separate the day from the night. Let them serve as signs to mark the seasons and days and years. And let them be lights in the expanse of the sky to give light on the earth." And it was so. God made two great lights, the greater light to govern the day, the lesser light to govern the night. He also made the stars. God set them in the expanse of the sky to give light on the earth, to govern the day and the night, and to separate light from darkness. God saw that it was good. There was evening. There was morning, which were already in place, but now with the corresponding bodies. The fourth day. Human beings' relationship with the heavenly bodies, it's an ancient and storied relationship. It's evident not merely in ancient cosmogonies, but also in ancient literature. Literature of all kinds. Now, the heavenly bodies aren't living bodies. They're not breathing entities. But they were often and are often given creaturely status in ancient literature. And in fact, right here in our text, the lights that God created are said to do what human beings do. They're personified. And in fact, they're given what human beings will later be given to do, and that is govern. In their case, govern the night and the day. Again, these are not scientific functions. They are human-oriented functions. Signs, seasons, days, nights, years, all functions attached to these created functionaries of sun and moon and stars and planets. The earth revolving around the sun, the earth rotating on its axis, functioning bodies that govern time and days and nights and seasons and years. All of these essential to plant, to animal, to human life. Verse 14, day 4 begins with God's decree that indicated the functions of the functionaries, the function of separating day from night, the function of marking out the seasons, the days and the years, and the function of giving light that is so essential to life on this earth. And then God assigned them their work of governance, and He declared them to be what? To be good. Which we saw last week, as we learned, means that God created, that everything that God created here functioned just as it should function. It functions just as He intends it to function, as perfectly as it possibly could. It was good. It was good. Thus, at the end of day 4, everything was just as it needed to be for God to put in place the final pieces of His relational creatures. We have time, day 1. We have weather, day 2. We have food, day 3. We have governors and markers of time, day 4. Table set. The cosmic table is set. You're probably thinking, well, you know, I could probably live there. We got time, we got weather, we got food. It's there. I could probably live there. The habitation was prepared. Prepared for living, breathing, relational creatures. One of which will be fully capable of personally relating to God in a higher, fulfilling way. Which is actually where this story of beginnings is ultimately heading. God has prepared the environment. It's time for the creatures. And we'll pick those up next week. I want to encourage you to look around this week, to really take some time to get out in God's creation. Whether you do it on a walk, whether you do it maybe the seat of a kayak or a canoe, whether you do it on a bicycle, however you choose to do it, just get out. Look around you. Look what God has put in place, and as we're going to see next week, ultimately to sustain you for a purpose. Get out there and look what he made so that He could have you here to have a relationship with you
what marvelous gifts He has given. Thank Him for what you see. Worship Him for what you know about Him, what you can observe about Him from His creation. But more than that, use what He has given you for His glory. One example that we've seen in the text so far, time. Time. Time is a precious gift. It's a precious gift. We only get so much of it. Only so much of it. Passes pretty quickly. Pretty quickly. The cosmos has seasons, but you know, so does human life. How quickly the spring of childhood becomes the summer of youth, it becomes the autumn of adulthood, and before you know it, the winter of old age is beginning to set in. I'm feeling the chilly winds blow as I speak. Time is precious, folks. It's precious. God means for us to use it. To use it for the good work of life stewardships. The good work of His kingdom. All of which is to be to His glory. And so we are to love God. We are to love other peoples with the days of our lives. If you don't take advantage of this great gift of time and love God and serve God and love other people, if you don't do it, you'll either wind up so callous you won't care at the end, or you'll live your last years with the sad regret of love's lost opportunities, which are often experienced in old age and loneliness. Oh, folks, God has given us a wonderful gift of time. Live and love well with this great gift that is the time of your life. Also, in closing, I want to revisit that fear that I talked about earlier. The fear under which the earliest human beings constantly lived. Fear of flood, fear of famine. Incidentally, this is a fear that as we continue through Genesis, God will eventually allay, but only after He opens the firmament in judgment, wipes out nearly every person on earth, and then promises to never do it again. The first people to read Genesis 1, those Israelites wandering in the wilderness under Moses' guidance, they were also people who lived with a lot of fear, a lot of anxiety about the time in which they lived and who they were and what God was doing and what was going to happen to them. And God's demand of us from the creation account itself, God's demand of His people has always been for us to trust Him. Always been for us to trust Him. To not trust in human wisdom. To not trust in human strength. But to trust Him. It was a struggle for our earliest ancestors, that's true. It was a struggle for the wandering wilderness community. And it continues to be a struggle for us today. To simply trust God. This account of Genesis 1 should make trusting God that much easier. For the God who so marvelously made everything, made everything, as we will see and are seeing, for our good. All He asks is that we trust Him. Trust Him. What are the anxieties of your life? What has rocked your world recently? What is the fear with which you live the days of your lives? What's the worry that you continue to hold on to and not let God have? What is burdening you? The good news is that the God who was in the beginning and the God who created everything that He created just so you would have a place and a God who, when we messed it all up, provided redemption and salvation and is now preparing a place with Him. That God loves you. That God will be faithful to you. That God will care for you. Let go of the fear. Release the anxiety. Stop the worrying. In the beginning, God. Bow with me. It's a praise team if they'll come. These are unsettling days in which we live. Life in this fallen world and failing bodies, flawed minds. It's always been a place of trouble and struggle. Job said that man is born to trouble as the sparks fly upward. It's part of life. The issue is what we do with it. It's what we do with it. God only asks a couple of things from us. One, that we obey Him. Two, that we trust Him. Everything kind of boils down to that. It's pretty simple when you think about it. At least in theory. Obey Him and trust Him. He's worthy of it. You can trust Him. You can count on Him. He's faithful. And His grace is always sufficient. Father, we bow this morning in closing because that's what finite, fallen, failing, flawed creatures should do in Your presence. We cannot make it on our own. We realize that if You were to take Your sustaining, providential hand away, for even the smallest fraction of a second, all would break into chaos. Father, we are so dependent upon You. And as we're going to learn relationally, You have made us to function interdependently. You've shown us how to do it. You've made provision for us to do it. To function in relation to You that way, dependently, but also interdependently in relation to one another. You've put us here. You've built within us, Father, a desire for that. I thank You that You have made it possible for us to have a vibrant relationship with You, the living God. Beyond that, Father, an intimate relationship. And the Scriptures tell us that You delight in that, and that is just too much for us to understand. Or even to appreciate in its depths. Continue to draw us to You. Continue to teach us and to grow us up in You and in the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ. Continue to knit us together as a community here, Fellowship Baptist Church, and as well, Father, with others who are in Your kingdom, Your church. Help us to love You and to serve You. each and every day of our lives, the time that you've afforded us. Help us to love others, to show that love, even to those, Father, who are hard to love, who are unlovely, even to those who might be hostile toward us. Give us the grace to love in the time that you've given us to live.